Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how the companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode, Colm Lyne is a payment and fintech entrepreneur with more than 30 years' experience in financial services, spanning banking, payments infrastructure, regulation, and digital transformation. He founded Relex Payments in 2000 at an early stage of online commerce in Ireland and the UK. Relex grew rapidly alongside the rise of e-commerce and became one of Europe's leading online payment service providers. By the time it was acquired by Global Payments in 2015, Relex was processing more than 35 billion euros in transactions annually for over 14,000 customers, including airlines, insurers, telecom providers, and major consumer brands. Following the acquisition, Relex Financial Services was spun out and remained under Colm's ownership. That business later became Fire Financial Services, now trading as Fire, and focuses on helping businesses digitize how they get paid and pay out. The company supports services including euro and sterling bank transfers, foreign exchange, open banking payments, and debit card issuing, all built on its own in-house platform. Today, Fire processes billions of payments each year for thousands of business customers, including large financial institutions. Alongside building businesses, Colm has been closely involved in shaping the wider payments ecosystem and also invests in Irish and UK startups through his family office. Colm, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Aidan.
I hope I got everything in there in the right order. Right, let's take it back to the start. Where did the insight come for Relex at the time?
That would have been back in around 2000, I guess. I'd been working in a bank and I'd been in the kind of project management side, business analyst type role. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we had seen, I guess, at the stage was businesses coming to the bank looking for ways in which they could sell online and ways in which they could securely process those payments when it came. I think at the time there was no real solution that the bank could offer the merchants who were selling online, and they would, you know, send them a terminal, if you like, out in the post, and then they'd have to phone the customer and get the credit card details over the phone or whatever it was. And so it was the demand to see it and the requirement that people had to be able to process payments online. And I guess the challenge that the financial institutions would face when they were trying to provide those services, because it would be difficult for them to deal with hundreds and thousands of individual merchants who wanted to do this. So the idea of an aggregator or somebody sitting between the two made sense. Yeah. And it had started to happen in the UK, started in the US as well. We could see companies emerging that were this knot in the bow tie, if you like, between the two sides, making it easy for the financial institutions to onboard and to process the payments with these merchants, and then make it easy for the merchants to get connected, you know.
Okay. Would you classify yourself as an accidental entrepreneur, or did you always want to start a business at that stage?
I would be the latter. Okay. I would be somebody that had thought of many different ideas over the years.
This wasn't the first one.
No. And was always keen to you know, be the you know, the person kind of taking that challenge, I guess. Yeah.
And was it then just a case of, you know, finding the right product? You knew you kind of want, like, I often talk to entrepreneurs and they go, oh, you know, well, I'm an entrepreneur, and they kind of go out and try find something where, and then there's an awful lot of other entrepreneurs who find a problem, create the solution, and the business just kind of develops because of that, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't have necessarily used the word entrepreneur back then at that time. Yeah. Maybe wasn't in vogue, so I would have maybe just have seen myself more as a business person, right? You know, that I wanted to be a business person. And whatever business I was in was okay. Right. I had looked at, the internet was obviously fascinating at the time, you know, because in the late 90s as well, you could see things changing, and the way in which people got information, got access to things, got access to goods and services was changing. So I had looked at like being a broadband provider, I'd looked at being, you know, different things. A lot of them were related to the internet. And I remember doing a project in Ulster Bank at the time where we developed their website for them. And we became the world's first bank, in fact, to deliver real-time FX rates live on the internet, you know, where you didn't have to press the refresh key. So back then, that was a big deal. And it was this dynamic page that we were able to create with a local Dublin company that gave us the tech to do this. Yeah. And I remember thinking, this is like, there's a world of, you know, innovation. And opportunity here. Yeah.
And when, just as an aside, when you think about, because, you know, there's so many comparisons being made now in the age of AI with the age of the internet, what do you think are the similarities and what are the differences between, you know, the internet in its early stage and AI in its early stage?
I'm not there yet with AI. Okay. I have to say, I'm getting there.
Yeah.
And I certainly would use it, you know, in an incidental way myself, but I wouldn't necessarily depend on it.
Yeah.
I've seen, you know, with some of the uses that we've certainly tested with it, like whereas things are incredibly incorrect that come back from it. Do you know what I mean? So there's an assumption in people's heads that it might be that it's right, you know, when it gives you back. We did an exercise at one of our offsites where we asked AI about who the CEO was firing. It came up with some random name, you know? And then we said, "Are you sure it's not Column Line?" And they said, "Oh yeah, sorry. It is." But he's actually retired now. And I said,
"News to me."
So I think for me, the essence of the internet that emerged back in the 90s. Was the connectivity?
Yeah.
You know, the like what tools you used in that connectivity didn't really matter. So whether it was browser based or email or sending pictures or messaging or whatever it might be or accessing information, it was just the core concept of being connected to this network. That's what changed everything. You know, the applications have changed over the years, and I guess AI is another, you know, massive wave that comes into that.
Yeah.
But for me, just I think that once people were connected to the same network, like, you know, the world was open, basically.
It's that idea, and I say it to people an awful lot. Like, people think about the you know, the internet, and they go, oh, yeah, you know, Amazon was the great internet company. They go, well, no, it wasn't an internet company. It just used the internet. And I think it'll be the same ultimately with AI. It'll be the people that deploy AI that will be the big winners rather than necessarily those that develop it. I had an example the other day. I was talking to somebody about them, some younger members of staff, and I mentioned Lucent and Nortel, and they kind of look at you and go, who are they? And you go, they were the big companies of the internet age. Going back to the starting the business, you know, when you are starting a business, whether you call yourself an entrepreneur or just a straight up business person, you know, you have an awful lot of hats to wear. Like, yeah, it's not just about the product specific. You've got finance, raising money and things like that. It's very difficult to be good at all of them.
It is, and I'm not. And I think that's the thing. Like, and you're absolutely right. Like, even in a smaller company, you do have to wear many different hats, and often for a long period of time. And you also have to be... when you're the CEO or the founder of a business, you're often the point that people go to as well. So, you know, you could be sitting at your desk and somebody will come to you, do you have a second?
Yeah. You know, that every question. Problem is your problem.
And it becomes, and it might be something to do with finance, or it's something to do with this. And then the next minute it could be an issue with the product. Next minute it's an issue with a customer, you know, or an opportunity with a sale. Or how we go about marketing ourselves. How do we message? How do we present this? And so things... And there is an expectation that you're going to have the answer a lot of the time, when in actual fact you realize that maybe you don't actually have the answer. Yeah. But and sometimes the people have the answer already themselves, but they maybe haven't quite worked it out, right? So you have to become the catalyst by which they make the decisions, really. And so you kind of you try to distinguish between the decisions that you do make, which are yours to make, and then you become something that people use, so that they can make the decisions themselves, you know, and that they're more empowered then over time. But at the early stages, yes, you are everything. Mm. You are like, and you're hopping from Billy to Jack in the course of a day, and you can have your worst day and your best day on the same day because of the nature of that. So you can have 1 minute you're elated because the phone rang, you know what I mean?
And then you're annoyed because the phone rang.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's the wrong number, you know, so you're deflated again. So it is that thing about not just coping, I think, with all the disciplines, but also coping with the roller coaster that comes with that too, you know, that it's up and down a lot, you know.
And it's all, you're on all the time, like it's 24/7.
It is, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's never a break.
Yeah, yeah. Looking back, I think you realise now that it's a lot more isolating than what you feel it is at the time, you know. You don't really feel it at the time, but when you look back at it, you realise that it is a lonely and soul on your own job, you know.
Yeah. And do you think, you know, when you look back at it and you go, I always think it is, you know, whether it's youth or it's naivety, there's a certain advantage in both of those, because if you knew what it was like, you'd never probably do it.
I think also the feeling that you've nothing to lose.
Yeah.
You know, you've got support from home. So you're you know, you've got that, which is really important for you. And then you're starting out and you're trying something. Mm. And so there's nothing to fear really from getting it wrong. You know, John Teeling was a huge mentor to me, and both personally before I went to college and then during college and then subsequent from college as well. And he always used to say that it was, you know, mistake was just getting something wrong and it didn't matter, you know. And so I think if you approach it in that way, as long as you can kind of see it, that it is wrong, and that you're able to adapt, you know, I think it's okay. So I think that fear of, you need to be sure that you're not afraid of getting it wrong, because you will get inevitably things wrong, you know, and you've got to be able to kind of spot that and to be able to move on. So I think I was blessed in many ways because I didn't have all the big words, the big business words, do you know what I mean? So it was awful, a lot of common sense really that just came and prevailed. About, you know, you had to look after the customers, you needed to keep them happy, you needed to engage and talk to them and all that. And there's nice words around that now, you know, customer success functions and all this sort of stuff, right? But like, these are sometimes the very obvious things that you need to do, you know, and you need to be able to make something and then you need to be able to sell it. And they're two very, very different things in your organization. Making something is sometimes easier, and selling it is really, really hard. Mm. You know, so finding distribution, finding somebody to buy your product, finding somebody who will not just want it, but actually want it from you as well, particularly in the payment space, is really challenging and really tricky. So you can make the best thing in the world, but you're never going to sell it, you know, for some reason, right? Even though it's a great product. So you have to kind of work out, you know, well, where do you, how much time do you spend making the product that you have, and then how do you find the distribution for it? And we were fortunate over the years because we got into great partnerships who, when you think about what Relex effectively was that we took away pain from the acquiring banks, the banks that gave the merchants the ability to be able to accept payments from a MasterCard and Visa and that. And we took away the pain for them to have to deal with thousands of individual merchants who wanted to integrate and do technical support with them. So they were happy to refer the customers to us. And when the customers then knew that AIB Merchant Services or Elavon or Bank of Ireland were you know, referring us to their customers, the customers were happy.
It's kind of an imprimatur there.
So we were certainly in the right place at the right time, you know, and then built on it over the years.
And do you think when you look back at the product development, do you think an awful lot, because you raised something there about, you know, you can build a great product, you can build your product and you keep on going and trying to refine it and build the best one, right? Yeah. And, or is it better to kind of get a product out there and get it working and then refine it as you integrate with the people who are using it, because they are going to be the ones that are telling you, this doesn't work, this works, this doesn't work.
Yeah, that's often the case, that you are better off iterating. I think certainly in the space that we're in now, you find that the, you know, whatever they might call it, the MVP nowadays, that it is a, I think it's a, it's a bigger product than maybe that it used to be. It used to be minimum, you know, but I think now it's a lot more. Like, if you want to really get somebody to use your stuff and to buy the stuff from you that you've made, because ultimately business is, as I say, just about making and selling. And if you want somebody to do that, I think you've got to have a really compelling proposition these days. One of the things that I spend a lot of time on is knowing the product that we've built is one thing, and describing that product and what it does is one thing. But then truly trying to understand the reason why somebody wants to buy that is the hard bit.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that sometimes we kind of gloss over. I've made something great. Isn't that glass amazing? Isn't it just wonderful, you know? But yet nobody wants it. Nobody's thirsty right now. Nobody needs to drink that water. So how I can't sell it, right? So a lot of the time we try to focus on what we call the proposition, which is the reason why people buy the stuff that we have. So if you've enough in your product to create a proposition, yeah, then go to market with that, absolutely. But if you don't have enough for that trigger point to occur, for somebody to say, yes, I want that, then I won't. And certainly with fire, that's what we found over the years as well, was that we could create a kind of a base product. And Relax, I guess, was the same way. And then over the years, we added on more and more and more services to that so that it became more holistic, if you like, and more complete for our customers so that they could. And that's good from a revenue point of view and from a retention point of view, too. You know, to have long term relationships with customers who use you for more than one thing, you know, makes a lot of sense.
And then when you look at that product development, you know, when you looked even, you know, 2-3 years into the Relax or even into fire, and you looked at the possible products that could be developed at that stage, and you look now at the products you actually have, you know, the actual products are probably, you probably never even thought of half the products that are now in operation back when you started the companies.
Yeah, and there's also the danger of doing too much,
right,
as well, you know, and I think we probably got a little bit of that disease in the early years in fire, where we tried to make too much product for too many people. And we didn't have the focus that we now have. And so I think focus is also a very helpful trait to have in your organization. Certainly there will be components to the product that, yeah, you probably may have seen them there, but you mightn't have thought that. I thought with fire, for example, I really thought that the era of what we call account-based payments, which would be the ability for people to pay directly from their bank accounts at the point of sale and not use cards, I thought that would have happened much faster.
Right.
So 10 years ago, I was convinced that like across the UK and Ireland, like this has happened in all other, many, many other countries around the world, you see people paying from their accounts rather than with their cards, right? So it was very... It happened in places like the Netherlands, that happened in Germany.
On a B2B basis,
no. P2B, so okay. Consumers paying businesses. Okay. And they would, like, you know, either scan a QR code, they would tap a link, they brought to their bank account, they authenticate themselves, and the payment is made from their bank account to the retailer's bank account in real time, right? It's common in Brazil, for example, it's common in India, it's common in China. And I thought 10 years ago in my wisdom that, yeah, this is going to happen here in a year or two, you know, but it's still been spoken about. It's still been talked about. It's got a particular, I think, impetus at the moment because the EU and the UK is concerned about their payments sovereignty, if you like. And they're looking at a dependency upon Visa and MasterCard, and the ECB and the UK, the Bank of England, would both be public in terms of saying that they feel that an alternative to Visa and MasterCard would be appropriate. And that alternative that they're seeking is going to be some form of digital payment that comes from an account, right? And if you think about it, you probably have 2 or 3 banking apps on your phone. And so why can't you access that app in real time at the point of sale and just technically make a payment from it to the payer, to the payee, right? And of course you could technically. So there's no tech barrier anymore. And the regulation has also changed over the last number of years so that third parties can now access your account, you know, on your behalf and with your consent. And they're able to initiate payments from your account, you know, with your consent as well. So we're finding that the changes in the regulation, the changes in the technology is always opening up new opportunities, if you like. Mm. But for me, the, as I say, I really thought that that wave would come in.
Yeah.
I think it was a small wave that was far out rather than a big wave, you know.
But yeah, yeah, it's an interesting point about the payments network and in terms of the adoption in different countries, right? Because you look how long it took America to adopt chip and pin and tap, right? It's not that long ago you'd be over and you'd swipe your card and you had to sign the thing in a department store in the US. And we were all kind of going, what's this about? And people just go over and it's like sign Mickey Mouse and the thing, and nobody ever checked it, you know. And yet you have other countries that are always at the forefront.
Yeah. No, I mean, and you've got the Irish banks trying to get Zippay off the ground imminently, which is the second iteration because it was Yippay before, and they ran into issues from a regulatory perspective, from what I understood. And so you are seeing the institutions realizing that the way that people pay and the way that people get paid is there is a big change coming. And that change, if you think about it, what was the card always doing? The card was just an instrument that you used to basically move money ultimately from your bank account to the bank account. So when you start to remove all those links in the chain, in theory, payments should get faster, payments should get cheaper and more secure, right? Because there's less people involved in the chain. You're pushing the money from your account, which means it's safer because it's not like you have to give a number to somebody for them to pull the money, right? So it's what we call a push payment rather than a pull payment. So it's inherently cheaper, inherently safer. And yes, we have seen, the only question is, really in the different economies throughout Europe and the UK, is who should take the lead with this? Mm. Is it the central banks? Should be left to industry? Like, so who takes, how do we create an environment to see this innovation happen yeah. right?
Because the technology is obviously there.
Exactly, yeah. And the regulation is getting there, yeah.
Yeah. And the point of customers, I always think they're great at telling you what's wrong with a product, but not necessarily telling you what the solution is. And that must come to you all the time. So how do you deal with that?
I think you have to, when somebody will say to you, I don't like doing this, or I don't like using our product because of X, Y, and Z. And I think your immediate thought is like, oh, I can fix that for you. And, hands down, stop doing what we're doing and try and fix something. But you have to be careful that you don't be like kind of customer led, but that you be market led.
Okay. Right.
So if you think that you can, if you think that what you're doing can be sold to a group of people with the same problem. So the market for us would be, if you define your market as a group of people with the same problem to be solved, then absolutely go and, produce something that, and make something better, because you know that you can take this to a group of people rather than one specific customer. You don't want to end up with, a specific product in place for each customer. That's very hard to scale. Yeah.
It's kind of the flip side of what we were talking about in a few seconds ago about the risk of distractions with new products, but. On the flip side of it, how do you make sure that the level of innovation doesn't fall?
Yeah,
it's a spectrum that you can go either side. You can be over innovative and end up getting distracted, or under innovate and not be there. So how do you tread that line?
I think you have to try and make the innovation a kind of a almost like a seed for differentiation with what you're doing, right? So. And it's very hard to differentiate your product today because other people can make the same stuff as you, maybe with AI or whatever, in a very quick space of time. So you try to differentiate yourself then by being innovative in the area of service. So maybe I can actually service the customer in a different way, and the position that you take within the market too. So you might decide that innovation doesn't just apply to the product and the features of the product itself, is what I'm saying. And innovation can actually pertain to other attributes of your differentiation that you want to implement. So if you differentiate yourself by being You know, like we, for example, would compete with high street banks today, and we have large corporate customers that need to maybe open up hundreds and thousands of accounts. They can get the same account from a high street bank as they can from us, right? But with us, they can open that account in real time through an API.
Okay.
Right? But with a bank, they can't. So we've serviced the customer in a different way to the bank. And that's what makes us different. And maybe the innovation comes not so much in the core account that we've created, but the innovation comes in how you open that account.
Okay.
Right? And that's where the innovation comes from. And the servicing that we can provide to that customer. And we will give them an account manager and they'll be able to call that person and they'll be able to access the information in their account. It's like every time I go to, you know, a coffee shop on South William Street, Google will tell me you were here 6 weeks ago or whatever the case might be. But a bank still doesn't tell me when money hits my account,
yeah.
Right? So, and that's an age-old problem. So, well, like the essence of FHIR, for example, is to send like automated messages to your system every time money comes into any of your accounts.
Okay.
And we tell you where it's all come from. And you can automate your system and your technology to respond to us, to automatically divide that money up and to make payments out with that money,
okay.
Right, in real time. So seconds later, after receiving the money into an account, the money can be gone. You know, if that's your business model or whatever it might be. So again, our innovation there didn't come from the core feature of the product,
yeah.
Which is just a boring bank account.
We
don't call them bank accounts, obviously, because we're not a bank, right? Mm. So they're just the digital accounts. But they're fully, the accounts that we provide are fully clearing interoperable. So in other words, they have their own IBANs, BICs, and sort codes, account numbers in the UK. So they're just like a, you know, they have the same, all the same characteristics as a current account. But the difference came, yeah, from the way in which you access the service rather than the core service itself.
Okay.
So that's like one of the things I've learned over the years. And then I think you can bring innovation into the position that you take as well. If you kind of partner then with certain people, so you want to maybe, you know, get more distribution and more sales for your product. So maybe you partner with certain platforms. So you end up speaking to these companies who really aren't your customer, but they do a technical integration into your platform, and then their customers can become your customers.
Okay.
Yeah. So again, so I think you look for smarter ways to, and different ways to do things, you know. So I try to think of, because I think being really, truly innovative with a product these days is tough. You know,
yeah,
it's
there's
hard.
There's not that many new products
no,
out there.
No.
It's just new approaches as opposed to new products.
Yeah.
What do you think you've learned from being a serial entrepreneur between the RailX and the FHIR and things like that? You know, what lessons did you bring from the, and I suppose FHIR was slightly different in that it wasn't a brand new creation in a way, but you know, what mistakes did you learn from as you went through the development of RailX that you applied in FHIR?
I think the probably number one for me is the need for strategy.
Okay.
And to be clear about strategy, about your business, right? And that's the strategy that you have is not your hope for the future, right? But it's something a bit more solid than that,
yeah.
Right? And that you articulate the strategy and you try to make sure that everybody is on the same page as yourself in terms of like where you want to be. That there is a destination here and there is an endpoint and that we are all aligned that that's what we want to be. And I think the danger for me, and certainly I think one of the mistakes that we made was, as I said earlier, trying to be, maybe do too much for too many people with FHIR at the start, you know? And so I think a good strategy for me is one that has focus and one that is very clear. And it narrows the kind of narrows the opportunity for the organization. So that's what we've ended up doing over the past few years is really trying to narrow down and find your niche and being really happy with that, you know, and solve one problem very well,
right.
You know, rather than trying to solve
loads and a half hours.
Exactly.
I have an idea out there that you know, as a boss, you don't necessarily get, or a CEO, you don't necessarily get better at the job, but you do get quicker at making the important decisions and kind of clearing the and it kind of is related to the strategy thing, just clearing the fog and going, right, that's a decision I have to make, or that isn't a decision I have to make, that somebody else needs to make.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you're, certainly for me, that your board is also very important too, right? So having a board in place of people who will help you and will advise you, because, I mean, business isn't easy, right? And growing a business isn't easy. Starting a business isn't easy. Scaling a business is hard. You know, raising capital is hard. They're all big challenges, you know? And you need the perseverance, and you need the persistence and the determination to be able to keep going, because it's very easy to kind of say, you know, it's not working, right? And things will always go wrong. So I think having the and you get that support and that inspiration from other people around you as well. So you've got to have a strong network of people who will support you. Like, so I would certainly use our board, and we've got an amazing five people between here and the UK who are, you know, great industry veterans, if you like, who are really instrumental. They're not operationally involved, so they won't decide for you, but they will certainly guide you, and certainly when you have made a decision, they'll then tell you what they think, you know, which is really, really helpful. Yeah.
And then, you know, how do you manage the board or your investors when things aren't going well?
You tell them the truth,
right?
You know, you just lay it out, and I think they would ride the wave with you. You know, a lot. You know, all of the time, really. And there's never a time when somebody would jump ship. Not in my experience, anyway. They would recognize, because they're industry people, they would recognize that things do go wrong. You know, I mean, if you're trying to fire, right? If you take fire as an example. We're regulated. So the very essence of being regulated, you probably know this from your own business, like, is that you then have obligations to comply with a whole suite of legislative
You just can't go and do your own thing.
you have to comply, right? That's the basis on which you're allowed to do what it is that you do, right? And so we have to be, and we're regulated in two jurisdictions, right? As a 35-person company, we have... We're regulated in the UK, we're regulated in the EU by the Central Bank of Ireland, and in the UK by the FCA. So that immediately changes the landscape, and that immediately says you've got to be serious about those accountabilities. You can't be flippant about them. You have to be real about them, and you've got to make sure that you retain control of and governance of your organisation and of all the products and services, and that you know, you're genuinely a customer first, and you're looking at your duty towards that customer and making sure that you meet all those obligations. So I think that's a huge difference from having a tech business where you're making a piece of technology, you know, and you're not subject to the same level of obligation.
And which do you prefer, operating under the regulated or the unregulated business?
I think a friend of mine and I were talking about this one day, and I think everybody will do a regulated business once in their career, and it's a great thing to do. But you know, but it is, and in fairness, it's nothing to do. The regulator here is incredibly supportive. We've been working with them to as the landscape is changing, and as payment processing isn't just you know, for banks. Basically, there are non-bank payment service providers out there now, including Fire and a lot of other companies, and the regulators have been very good in terms of making sure that we get access to these payment schemes and these payment networks, you know, and that we don't necessarily have to go through the banks that you compete with in order to get access to these systems and schemes. So it is good to see, and innovation and competition has become something that, although it mightn't be formally a mandate for some regulators, it's something that they're very interested in, you know, making sure that there is an open and competitive market out there for people like me and others to be able to invest and to try and see if we can make products.
Because it's ultimately in the end customer's interest for that open and innovation to happen.
Absolutely. I think if you have if you have customers who you know, if you want to encourage innovation and competition in the market needs to be open and accessible. That's the point, you know. And people will you'll get people like me who will come in and risk their capital to try and create a product, you know, and if it fails, it fails.
Yeah.
You know,
but it has to fail on its own merits and not because of a barrier.
Exactly, yeah. That's the point. Yeah. So I spend a lot of time in the UK on that particular issue as well.
Okay. What's your approach to change?
Change as a concept,
you know, in terms, because you're in a business that constantly changes and running a business in an industry that constantly changes.
Yeah, I don't think about change in that way, maybe. I think about, I do think a lot about accessibility.
Okay.
Right? I think about accessibility to the market. I think about our customers' accessibility to our product. I think about the digitalization of things. I think about how things are going digital. I suppose that is all change, you're right, like in that sense. So I'm thinking about how things have gone very digital. I'm thinking about how businesses want to integrate their systems into their accounts, you know, into their payment processing, how they want to automate stuff, how they want to streamline stuff. So I think I was given the example the other day that, like, if you're using Spotify and you're listening to some music and you decide that you wanted to tip the artist, you know, you're going to hit a button on Spotify just to tip them, and the money will automatically be pushed out of your bank account to the artist's bank account, right? Without you ever leaving Spotify.
Yeah.
Right. And that's technically possible today, okay? And that is a change. And that type of stuff fascinates me, because I think when I was starting out my career, I went to the branch every Friday to pay the bills with the little folios down the bottom,
yeah,
right? Then I got online and we set up, you know, the utility companies were already there, and we could pay bills. Then I got the mobile apps and so on. Now we're in the era of embedded finance and embedded payments. So in other words, aspects of your banking, aspects of your payments will be embedded into third-party apps. So the example is Spotify, so that you won't actually have to go to the mobile app even of your bank to make a payment or to even see your balance. If you wanted to see your balance, you can put it on the home screen of your phone, right? Okay. If you want to, right? Because it'll just be simply, and you will always authorize that, and you'll always be in control of that, right? And you'll be able to log into your bank and stop Spotify sending these payments if you want to do so, because they're all push payments and you've never once given anybody your IBAN, right? And so this is all technical. So for me, that change is imminent. And whether the change is made, you know, with a bank transfer that's been pushed out of your account or a digital euro or whatever, I don't know. But it won't be card based. Mm-hmm. And I think that for me is incredibly exciting, because what it means is that if you're you're a coffee shop, a retailer, and it's a Thursday afternoon, it's come to lunchtime, say, and you want to be, something's broken, and you need to get a service charge done, but you don't have the money in your account right now. So you press a button on your till, and it basically just says, settle this morning's transactions. So all the transactions that you got this morning automatically now settle into your account instantly, right?
Okay.
And you've got a debit card or something yourself, and you can then call up somebody and give them the card and order something which can be delivered to you now, right? So that making the settlement and the movement of money instant. So SEPA Instant is just about upon us, right? It's an incredible thing. But the banks have made SEPA Instant available only through your mobile app and your web apps.
Right.
Now, what happens when SEPA Instant becomes a service that can be embedded
in anything?
In anything, right? Then it becomes incredibly exciting. And that's where FHIR is headed.
Yeah.
So FHIR has just got the approval to be a direct member of SEPA Instant. And it's also, we're joining the SEPA schemes as a direct member at the moment. And so that means that we will be able to offer this incredibly, I believe, innovative experience, which is a fully integrated and embedded instant SEPA payment that you can put into any third-party application. So any business wants to be able to get money in real time, or send money out in real time from their own apps, from their own technology, we'll be able to do it,
Fascinating. You mentioned something earlier on. Explain to me where you see the big differences between starting a business and scaling a business.
I, I look, starting, I think, is in my head is always the until you get a customer, you know. Mm. There is a glorious moment in business when you get your first customer that's not a family and friend, you know.
just to be nice.
Yeah. When you have somebody who's actually willing to pay you for what you've got, mm-hmm. right? You have validated your proposition. You have validated the need. You have validated that somebody's, you know, as I say, prepared to actually pay for the service that mm-hmm. you've created, for the product that you've created. That for me is a glorious moment. And there's a thing where, you know, a curve that everybody loves, and it's kind of, it goes from A to B, and lots of businesses can get to B. But how do you get to C? Mm. And this is the challenge. And so, yeah, the challenge of scaling often becomes one of distribution. And I think for me, in my experience, the distribution has always been 10 times harder than the startup. You know, you can get to a certain point, and you're nearly always guaranteed to get to a certain point. But to get beyond that is incredibly difficult. Mm. And it often takes much, much more money and a lot more risk with that money in order to be able to truly get the distribution that you want.
And then do you think that there are people who are, you know, very good at starting a business, but that will never be able to scale a business, and people that maybe are better scalers than starters?
Mm. I mean, conceivably, you, everybody will have, I guess, traits which are good in one thing and, you know, maybe not so good in another. Do you know what I mean? I think I'd see myself certainly as a very strong product person.
Okay.
You know, I'd be leaning towards that. Like, make the product, get the product made, design the product well, design it so it can scale, you know.
Okay. Let's talk about the Relex transaction and the decision to sell it, right? What was the motive at the time to sell it? Was it that you wanted out, or that you just couldn't take it further yourself, or did somebody just come in and say, here's a crazy price, and you said, thanks very much?
No, I think, first of all, it was the acceptance that the status quo wasn't really going to work for us, okay. right? That we had grown really, really well over the years, and we'd got great distribution through partnership deals that we had done. We were providing what we call online payment services for financial institutions in the UK and Spain and France and in different countries throughout Europe, as well as directly to merchants and to retailers as well. And we knew that we either, because it was a pure technical company, so we felt that we needed to move more into the financial side of payment processing if we were going to be successful. So I think the trick there was that we also had partnerships in place with a number of large financial institutions at the time. And I think what's very important is when you don't really have the luxury of selling your business when you want to sell it. The market kind of determines when you should sell it. Right. And a number of the card acquirers had gone out and purchased similar companies to Relex. And I think from our perspective, we were kind of thinking that ultimately was where we should belong. Mm. Because these card acquirers are the financial institutions that provide merchants with the ability to be able to accept cards. Excuse me. They'll give them, you know, terminals if they're point of sale, they'll give them EPOS solutions if they're stores, and now they give them an online gateway if they're selling online. And so we knew that these card acquirers needed a gateway, and a lot of them didn't have gateways. One by one, they were buying gateways, so we didn't want to be the last one.
Mm.
And we felt that, like, yeah, it's very important for us to be able to secure a deal. And I think if we found the right home for this gateway, this piece of technology now, and then it could become something really, really important. And I think I never saw myself, while I was an owner of it, you're almost like a steward of it. Like, right. You know what I mean? You're
there was always going to be an exit from it. It wasn't ever. Yeah.
And it's not an exit for the business. Mm. You know, you're just passing it to somebody else to scale, to continue on its development. And what was incredible about that particular deal was that the people in Relex became it wasn't that the product became a very important component for Global Payments, who acquired us, but the people became very important people in Global Payments. And many of the people went on to become very, very senior, you know, figures within Global Payments and still are to this day. One of them, in fact, is recently promoted to being global head of one of the product divisions within Global Payments. And it really is fascinating to hear that still. So it was definitely the right decision.
Yeah.
You know, it definitely made a really good company, a great company. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't right that I should remain, you know, as the owner of that. It simply just didn't make sense. It was best for me as the custodian of it, almost to hand it off and say, yes, here, this is where it needs to go next, and somebody else is better placed. And they had distribution.
Yeah, okay.
So they had literally hundreds and hundreds and thousands, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of merchants who they had, you know, all of whom were probably going to be selling online, and they needed a gateway. So they were able to, you know, integrate the technology into their platforms worldwide. Mm-hmm. And to this day, the Relix Gateway still processes and is processing for Global Payments, who've now just merged with Worldpay. Mm-hmm. So they're becoming the largest card acquirer, right? By market cap, I think, and that they would now be for all of their retailers, including those in the West Coast of America, are all processing their online transactions through the Relix Gateway in Dublin.
Which you would never have ever gotten it
not
to
at
that
all.
Point.
Yeah. No, and that's a huge success. Yeah. You know, that made the system, and it made the staff, and it made the customers of Relix really important and really happy. So.
And how important, you know, because, you know, a lot of the you know, when you sell a business, there's two parts. There's obviously the financial, but then there's also, you know, the staff side of it. I'm making sure where the staff are going to, the cultural fit is going to be right. Because oftentimes when we're talking about mergers and acquisition, we always look at it from the acquirer's side and not necessarily the target side, you know. So how important was it for you to get that you knew it was going to the right home, as opposed to just any home that was going to write you a check?
Yeah. No, it is a great point. And I think we were very fortunate, because as is often the case, many of the businesses that were interested in acquiring Relix, we actually had partnerships with them for many years before. So in the case of Global Payments, we had partnered with them, I think it was 4 years maybe before the deal. Mm-hmm. So we would have known the people very, very well. Okay. And they were, you know, so impressive and so exceptional to deal with as well, because they, you know, they write down to their CEO calling me at certain times throughout the process, and everything really, really slick. And a company, I suppose, that has managed its growth through acquisitions over the years as well. So very, very slick at doing it, and very just ultra professional in terms of what they wanted to achieve. So it, yeah, I think the everybody was very pleased, and there was no doubt about it that the staff got great opportunities like that they didn't have when Relix was an independent company, you know, and that was the big thing.
And when you look at Fire, do you view yourself as a custodian of that business too, in terms of it ultimately will be the right thing for it to be acquired at some point?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a bit like your children, you know. They're always going to be booted out of the house at some stage.
I'm not emotionally attached to it in that sense.
Yeah.
And you want it to be, you know, what we have built is a very, you know, effective and important piece of technology that's regulated, that's able to, you know, as I say, create accounts, cards, do open banking payments and FX transactions in real time through an API. And I've no doubt that, you know, as the world becomes and as finance becomes and payments becomes more embedded, platforms like Fire will be very, very important for financial institutions to have. So, and would I be happy? Yes, absolutely. If it made sense for one of those institutions to say to us, you know, we really need something like this as part of our strategy for the future, then absolutely, you know, we would be open to those discussions, you know. And as I said, I think it's very important to be open. I always, you know, through our family office, we're invested into a lot of different businesses and funds. I think it's over 20 different startups and 5 different VC funds now. And, you know, whenever anybody gets the opportunity to sell their business, I say sell it.
Sell it, yeah.
You know, I don't hesitate because that opportunity, you know, might never arise. Or you could be waiting a long time, and you don't determine that sometimes. And there is a kind of an annoying thing where sometimes you read about people saying things that Irish companies sell too soon, you know. And I don't think they sell too soon. They might sell early.
Yeah.
But it's not too early, you know. It's a fact of the ecosystem that we have, and I would always sell. I would always say to people, sell, you know, bank the money.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. What do you think is the hardest job as the CEO?
I would say probably it's that kind of coping with the ups and the downs, mm-hmm. and the frequency at which things change. So the from one minute to the next, like you're depressed and then you're elated and then you're depressed.
Yeah.
So it's that roller coaster, is the hard bit. It's not so much, I mean, when you're down and you can manage it, you know what I mean? And you can cope with it and you can work your way out of a hole. That's okay. But then it's having to make sure that you put on the right face, mm-hmm. the right time, and that you have to dig deep sometimes to get that energy, to be able to, you know, make sure that you're bringing people along and that you're helping them, and that probably the nicest part of the job is being the mentor, mm. and being the coach. And, you know, when people come to you and they're maybe blocked, they can't move forward with a certain particular issue, and, you know, you grab a pen, you get a whiteboard and you maybe work something out with them, and then they say, yeah, brilliant, that's great, thanks, that's what I'm going to do. And it could be an evaluation, it could be a technical issue, it could be any issue. That's the nicest part of it, really, you know, when you release somebody from as I say, from a path where they're stuck. But the hard part is I suppose the uncertainty, facing the uncertainty of not knowing what tomorrow is going to bring.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, but it's not knowing what tomorrow is going to bring is going to be the problem. Yeah. So then, you know, is resilience the most important personal characteristic as a CEO?
A bit of persistence, I think just persistence and keeping, sticking, not losing sight of the vision, mm-hmm. you know, is very important. Right. And not losing sight of what it is that you want to be. And sometimes you do have to kind of look back and say, where was I 3 months ago? Where was I 6 months ago? Where was I 9 months ago? Because it can feel like you're not making progress.
Yeah.
But if you do look back and you say kind of 3, 6, 9 months ago, actually, I'm okay here. Mm. I'm making progress. Mm. Maybe not as fast as I'd like, but I'm actually moving forward. I'm in a better place now than when I was 6 months ago. Yeah. Okay, that's good. Yeah.
So do you hate losing or love winning?
Ooh, I like winning.
Yeah. It's funny. It's about 50-50 when I ask.
Is it?
It's funny. Yeah. It is. But then the follow up to it always is the when it comes to your decision making, are you a fast or slow decision maker?
Well, I'd be deliberate.
Deliberate. Okay.
Yeah. Neither fast nor slow, really. I think I'd be fast for certain ones, but then I'd be quite slow for other ones. Yeah. You know. So, and I'd be a more of a consensus, deliberate type decision maker.
And then do you make your decisions based off data or gut feel?
Oh, data.
Data.
I don't like opinions, and so I would regularly kind of say to people when we're having chats about stuff like I don't need your opinion on this. I just need the data.
Data.
You know, show me the facts. You know, give me the numbers, the number of customers. You know, we have a very big problem because loads of customers are ringing in, complaining about stuff.
Yeah.
You know, what does that mean? Yeah. Like, you know, it means nothing. You know.
Then in that case, do you obsess about the small things?
In certain areas,
right?
Yeah, in particular, in I think in sales and product. I would be obsessive about making sure that, you know, this presentation looks immaculate. This pitch that we're making to this customer is going to put us the best one of all the proposals they're going to receive. Our one will look the best and be the best compared to all the competitors. That would be something that I would think about a lot. And from a product perspective, I would often look at the design of the product, mm-hmm. and look at the, you know, the the, some of the models that may be supported and the way in which it's going to be constructed from a technical perspective, and kind of see, yep, that's right. We're not going to have issues of integrity. We're not going to have issues of resilience here. We're not going to have issues of, I suppose that this will work. I'm satisfied that this is going to work in an organized and extensible way. It's been designed correctly. Because if you send out a product with a bad design and you start developing it, you're going to run into difficulties.
Yeah.
If you send out a sales proposal, which isn't like top of the class, like you might not win that business. Right? So they're the two things that I would be kind of would be nosing around a lot. And
I had one guest said to me, he says, it's not whether it's a small thing or a big thing. He says, I obsess about the important things.
Yeah.
Small things can be important and some large things are not important.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You mentioned early on, John Teeling is somebody that has been a mentor for you, but who else have you sought advice from over the years?
I was very lucky with the, one of the great things I got access to was the Leadership for Growth program through Enterprise Ireland back in, it might've been 2008. And, great buddy, John Purdy, who passed away recently, was in the same cohort as me. So miss John terribly. It's very sad. We used to talk a lot.
He had a huge influence on a lot of people.
He did. Mm. He did. Yeah. Super fella. And we used to talk a lot about business, you know, and we were in a small group together and we'd meet up every couple of months in between the Stanford trips and you know, the scaling and growing things. So. So Stanford was really helpful for me in terms of putting, I suppose, the correct words on the gut feeling that I already had, if you know what I mean. I was able to like define things in a proper businessman-like way, business person. And then John would have been a big influence. I remember meeting Sean Melly. He's passed away as well, per Sean. But he was one of the guys in TCL Telecom, and he kind of got into the telecoms market as it was deregulating and was one of the first kind of, you know, business people, entrepreneurs to kind of take advantage of that deregulating market, which is not dissimilar to what we're doing, in payments, where we're looking at the deregulating of the industry too, and then that creates opportunities as well along the way. There's a lot of people out there in my network that I would stay in touch with regularly, who are kind of, Brian Caulfield is another great guy. I'm sure you know him, and Brian obviously heads up Scale Ireland and is, I'm honoured to be on the advisory committee there and helping, you know, to get the right messages across to try and help us here to build indigenous companies. We've got a very strong leaning towards FDI, and that's fine. That's, you know, no one's against that.
Yeah, but it can't be exclusively that.
It can't. And I think Brian and myself would share the same passion for, you know, for trying to make sure that, again, there's no barriers in place that we give. It's very, very, very difficult as an Indigenous, as a small Indigenous firm, to attract and to retain the staff that you need, in an environment where multinationals can pay, you know, phenomenal salaries to people. Yeah. It really is. It's a huge, huge challenge.
There's a natural crowding out there if we're not careful.
Yeah. And again, there's nothing wrong with having the FDI firms here. They're wonderful to have them here. And in fact, one of our portfolio companies at the moment is being acquired by one of the FDI firms that are here. So they're great for that as well. So it's a wonderful ecosystem that we have.
Yeah.
But I do think that sometimes we treat the Indigenous firms, with a kind of almost like a second or third place, when in fact they just need to be joined first, you know, that treat them equally. And try and see what we can do to really encourage, because I think there are people that naturally, there are people who love working in small companies where they feel that they're making an impact, right? That there's something that they're doing today and somebody's using that now. Mm-hmm. Right? Somebody's using that tech, somebody's using that product right now. I was the one who designed that, and it's now up on all of our brochures, it's up on our wall, it's up on our website, and I was the designer who was responsible for making that. You know, so it's that ability to be able to really be a part of an organization where you're not a cog in the wheel, but actually you are the wheel as well.
Mm.
And people, there are people who love that experience, and I think they might spend part of their career in a small company, part in a large company. Mm. You know, they might start in a large company and then move into a small company. It's really healthy to be able to do
but
that.
You need to let both flourish.
Exactly. Yeah, you do.
On that point of staffing and things like that, are you a hire talent or develop from within?
We would do a lot of development from within.
Okay.
Yeah. Particularly if they're, you know, you bring people in who are smart and people who are eager, and like, you can always teach them the stuff, right? You can always show them how the stuff works and how the stuff was done. So that's the hard bit. But teaching somebody to be enthusiastic, teaching somebody to be,
energetic and
interested in this stuff is hard. Do you know what I mean? So I think you look for all the right soft stuff and then you teach them the hard stuff, you know.
How do you feel about what you've already done in the two companies? When you look, we were talking about it earlier on, you know, the 3-6 mind, munch, but like when you look back now and you look at what you've achieved, how do you feel about it?
Interesting question. I don't think about it too much,
right,
to be honest. I'm kind of more about where I'm going rather than where I've been, mm-hmm. I think. I'm proud. I'm pleased. I think it was, it wasn't just me, but there was a team of people, and I was able to bring a lot of, I'm proud of not so much what I've achieved, but I think of the opportunity that we gave to a lot of people, mm-hmm. who would have been working with us over the years. And the team, the management team that we've had in both, have been people who have, you know, worked really hard and really enjoyed themselves, I think, in terms of what they have achieved too. So, you know, you're looking back at it, of course, you might have feelings about things you could have done differently and whatever else, but that's that, you know. So I don't tend to dwell on that really too much, you know.
But in the same way, do you think a lot of people don't celebrate their wins enough? That, you know, and like, you're a good point. You said you're always looking forward as opposed to looking back. But like,
yeah,
you then kind of miss some of the big achievements that you've made if you don't celebrate them every now and again.
I think the big achievement for me was leaving my job.
Right.
You know, and I still celebrate that every day, you know, 25 years later, you know. Yeah. So
becoming your own boss as opposed to somebody else.
Yeah. As I say, I think that was the step. That was the thing to celebrate.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've reached the black book time. Let's have a look and see. Okay, I'd say you know this man, right? And I'll let you know in a second who asked the question. But the question is, what question were you hoping Aidan wouldn't ask you and why?
What question was I hoping you wouldn't ask me?
Yeah.
I don't know if there was any question
that you wouldn't ask. You were hoping that I wouldn't ask, but that was good.
Yeah. No. There was nothing on my mind that I was worried about. No. Right.
Well, I'll throw in another one just in case, because I didn't ask it. And it does come up from time to time in terms of the final questions. What advice would you give to young people now?
Now? I guess... it's so different and so hard. Normally what I say to people when they ask me that question is, I don't do advice.
Right.
But I can tell you a story about something that happened to me. And if it's relevant to you, you can pick some of that experience and maybe think about it.
Yeah.
Right. Because giving advice to people is something that I would always try to avoid, because I'm only getting part of the story.
Yeah.
I don't get the full story because
they never get the full story. Yeah.
And my inclination would be to direct people towards, the art and humanity side of the world right now, rather than the business side of the world, you know. Something that I would be saying to people, it's not all it's cracked up to be.
We had one guest who is in the IT area and sold his business. And when I asked him what advice, he said, "I tell young people to become plumbers or electricians. There's a better future."
Yeah,
than that.
Yeah, I'd be inclined to go, you know, and study the, as I say, more of the arts, and like stay away from business entirely.
Yeah. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Colm Lyne. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.